Our food experts fire up some inspiration for Valentine's Day or a hearty winter meal. Are you planning to pick up some chocolates, perhaps in a heart-shaped box, for someone you love this Valentine's Day? You can thank a Victorian-era British chocolatier for that idea. His name was Richard Cadbury. Yep, that Cadbury. Strawberries have an even older romantic history. Strawberries were the symbol of Venus, the Roman goddess of love. Do you have your own special Valentine's food or meal? Do you need some ideas? How about advice for just a good hearty dish or stew to make any time this month to take the chill out of February? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with three of Maine's culinary all-stars about seasonal dishes and ingredients and food trends, such as African spices and veg-centric cuisine. Food for thought on Maine Calling, next. But first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. With this kind of weather, cold, blustery, snowy, did I mention cold? It is a great time to nestle indoors and cook up some comfort food, or maybe try a new recipe. Today we're going to talk about the foods of the season, from hearty winter stews to romantic Valentine's Day treats. I have three culinary experts with me to share their ideas and to talk about food trends. With me in the studio, Peggy Gradinsky. She is the food editor at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Nancy Harmon Jenkins is the award-winning author of several cookbooks and a food writer and speaker. And Sam Hayward, he is the award-winning chef and co-owner of 4th Street and Scales Restaurants in Portland. As always, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite winter food? What would you like to try but haven't yet summoned up the courage to do so? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I feel like it's an embarrassment of riches here in Maine to have such great minds in the studio with me. Sam, I want to start with something newsy. Tell us about the new food studies program at USM.
Yeah, I think this is really exciting. I only found out about it after a friend of mine had mentioned to me that the board of trustees at the university was considering a food program. And I think it's just started up. This is its first semester. Last evening, there was going to be a kind of a launch party to be able to explain and publicize it. There's very little that I know about it at this point, but it's an undergraduate minor program. I believe it's an 18-credit minor program. And I wish I knew more about it. I just think it's incredibly exciting that we have an academic program at a major Maine university that's actually devoted to exploring food as a subject of study. And I think there's some basic directions they're going in. One is hospitality and management. Another direction is entrepreneurship. And a third is food studies, history, environment, and so on. So this is going to be really exciting. It's going to be fun to watch this as it goes forward.
Almost makes you want to be a student again.
Well, I'm thinking about it.
Peggy, we want to talk about some foods that relate to the season. Valentine's Day is coming up. Do you have favorite romantic treats you make for the holiday?
I seem to have a very checkered history with Valentine's. Years ago, I spent the day in jail writing a story about jail food, and I feel like I once had a cavity on Valentine's. This year, I'm embarrassed to say there's a special on TV about a mass shooting, actually, that I think I want to watch because it was in Texas where I used to live. But so myself, I think a lot about it in terms of our coverage. I probably don't do so much myself. But I guess my main point would be, even though people who have jobs as food editors sort of try to tell you what to make and tell you what a romantic meal is and have lots of suggestions, I think that the most romantic thing would be to think about the person or people you are making something for. And, you know, the nicest thing you can do is tailor it to them. And what would they love and what would they consider sexy or romantic or loving.
So you use your creative energy thinking of something now for the paper, but previously for a magazine. But in reality,
Yeah, no, I'm sorry to say that if it falls on a weekend, I'll do a little better. When it falls on a weeknight, which might be my second suggestion for people for cooking for Valentine's, is maybe you want to think about food you can make ahead so that if you have to work, since I don't know anyone who gets Valentine's off, you can still pull off a nice meal if you're cooking at home, of course. And I'll just say one other thing, which is I made a little sort of like a cheesecake to bring in, and that was kind of my Valentine's to Nancy, another guest here, because she doesn't love sweets, but she did like marmalade, and this cheesecake has marmalade in it.
Nancy, you don't like sweets.
I'm not a big fan of sweets. I eat sweets now and then, but I don't like them at the end of a meal. And I especially don't like a great big humongous chocolate sweet at the end of a meal. To me, it's something that belongs maybe at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon when your blood sugar is low and you need a boost for it. But this tart that Peggy made is absolutely delicious.
We have it with us here in the studio.
We do indeed.
I'll try not to talk and chew at the same time.
So I also made something that I thought was going to be appropriate for Valentine's Day because it's called Persian Love Cake. And it came from a new cookbook, and it's got weird things in it, like rose petals. I mean, I think rose petals are very romantic. So it's got rose petals scattered all over the top of it, and it's got rose water in the batter. And
it's funny. There must be a theme. I had a friend bring me some peony jam this past week or 2 weeks ago.
Peony jam.
And I had never even heard of it. It's delicious.
It's kind
of subtle.
Peonies?
Yeah.
Wow.
So flowers in the – and, of course, nasturtium in salads were – in style, yeah. 20 years ago.
But I think Persian food and, you know, from Yotam Ottolenghi and the entire all sorts of Middle Eastern food is very, very hot right now. And there are many cookbooks being written in that direction.
Absolutely. So. I just, you know, I was thinking that when I was looking through this Persian cookbook where I got the recipe from, which is a new book. There's Naomi Duguid's book on a section of Persia called Azerbaijan. There are new Middle Eastern cookbooks coming out all the time. It's there's a great Aleppo cookbook that makes me cry every time I read it because of the disappearance of that really wonderful food town.
I think a lot of people are afraid to try. They may be hearing you right now. There's a new Persian cookbook, but think, oh my gosh, where do I start? I can't do that.
You start out on Forest Avenue because there are so many shops out there where you can buy things that you can't buy in your local supermarket probably. I mean, it's a challenge, but it's a really interesting challenge. And it's one way, I think. Now, I was talking with my daughter about this because she's organizing a group of people to start cooking with cooks from the 7 banned countries to give people an idea of
what. Great idea.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea. She asked me to find an Iraqi chef or an Iraqi cook in Portland, but of course my favorite Iraqi bakery was closed, so I couldn't do that. But in any case, it's a way to learn about another culture without having to travel there, without having to worry about whether you can get back into the United States or not after you've been there. And it's a way to understand. It's like the food studies program, and I hope they do a lot with that. The kind of immigrant groups in Maine that go way back. I mean, the first Europeans to come here were immigrants, and it's continuing today. And I think it's a wonderful way to get inside another culture is through its food.
Can I just add about rose water? Because I think you said there's rose petals in this.
Rose water also. And rose water. Can you taste it?
I did taste the cardamom for sure, and it's lovely and moist. But rose water, even though it sounds exotic, so to your point of people maybe being afraid of ingredients that seem unfamiliar, although I don't feel like that's a big issue in cooking today, certainly not among millennials who have very adventurous palates. But in any case, rose water, when you look at old colonial cookbooks, shows up all the time. I don't really, it sort of disappeared. I don't know why, but these other cuisines from the Mideast are bringing it back lately. Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of interesting that those infusions, orange flower water, rose water, and others that have been around for a long time, are almost more aromatic than they are something that shows up in taste. So as soon as I sniff this cake, even though it's quite cool, I could get the aroma of rose water pretty strongly.
Yeah.
Also fits somehow with Valentine's. Somehow, there's something about
roses.
Fragrance.
And perfume.
And just fragrance feels so.
Sam, now that you've taken a bite, I'm going to ask you a question.
Are you kidding?
You're known for taking advantage of what's in season at your farm-to-table cuisine. What are some of the fruits of the season right now? And we're talking about the sea, not the orchard.
Well, this is the time of year for some of the best nearshore Maine seafood harvest that we'll ever see. This is the season for, in state waters, that is, up to 3 miles off offshore, we get shrimp and scallops and urchins, which are three of my favorite seafoods. And since these tend to be small boats and they're going in and coming out on the same day, some of those seafoods are the best things that we can possibly have this time of year. We haven't seen Maine shrimp in much quantity, partly due, we think, to the warming of the temperatures in the Gulf of Maine. But there are some experimental boats out there that are operating outside of the closed areas that we have here in Casco Bay. And apparently they're getting their quota, they're getting their limit in just a couple of tows in a very short amount of time each day that they're going out. And I had some recently and just was knocked out by them. It's something I've missed so much.
I have too. I have missed Maine shrimp. So
I just bought 4 pounds at Harbor Fish.
Good for
just
you.
Just now.
I've never seen the prices as high as they are, of course, because it's so limited right now. But at least there are some out there. And that somehow feels hopeful to me in what otherwise is kind of a dark time. So that was really important to me to have over the weekend and made a big difference to me. Scallops are also wonderful, but unfortunately, both divers and draggers there's some controversy around the damage that could be done by those methods, and they're not very many big ones out there. They're coming in pretty small. So that's kind of an indication to me that maybe they're not as plentiful as they ought to be.
May I ask you a question about divers? I thought that was divers are actually individual divers who go down and
they
get them.
They do, yeah.
And I thought that was considered the less problematic
I'm sure that's
method.
True because they're certainly not doing any damage to the habitat. But some people say they clean out a bed and because it's so close by. And I'm not sure about that. I've never gone diving for them, although I've been interested. It's not unequivocally more acceptable than dragging.
Interesting.
So better would be not eating scallops at all, and who's going to do that?
Not me.
I want to ask you about urchins, though, Sam, because I don't see them. I see them on restaurant menus, but I don't see them being sold anywhere, and I want them.
They're often not popular for home cooks, I think, don't you? That the epicenter of urchin fishery is, I think, Washington County. I think that's where most of them are coming in, and they're fantastic.
And can you just go out and buy them, or do you have to wait for an urchin fisherman to show up?
I don't see them in the markets either. Yeah. I don't see them in the markets. I see them prepared in little wooden trays for the retail market, and I think that's how most folks and many restaurants actually experience them.
And we have a quick note from our producer who says, my husband gets urchin at Brown Trading or Harbor Seafood. So maybe not all the time, but sometimes if you're lucky.
Absolutely. I'll go right back down there and see if I can get some urchins to take home.
Nancy, I understand that you want to talk about orange marmalade. Why is that a thing this time of year?
Well, because the oranges are in season. You know, we get oranges all year round, and most of us are not aware that they have a season even, or because we don't live in orange country, perhaps. But they do, and the season really begins in November with the first sweet oranges, even green oranges. I used to sell green oranges in the Middle East when I lived there, and people loved those. And it advances on slowly, slowly, slowly through the rest of the winter. And along about the end of January, you start to get blood oranges coming in. And then shortly after that, you get what are variously called bitter oranges or Seville oranges or that's another name for
sour it. Oranges.
Our?
Sour.
Sour oranges. And those are the best oranges for marmalade. So usually if you're going to make really good marmalade, you want to make it in February. And you want to get a good supply of those sour or bitter or Seville oranges.
So I want to hear what you all are excited about. You have so much knowledge that you're I'll tell you what I'm excited about. I discovered Romanesco this past summer. And I loved it so much, I put a picture on my Facebook page. Have you had a discovery lately that you want to share with everybody?
I have not cooked with this yet. And again, this is really Nancy's area, not mine. But I was at the Cheese Iron in Scarborough. And they had, instead of machine-made couscous, they had hand-rolled couscous for sale.
Was that from Tunisia?
Yes, from Tunisia. Yeah. I bought a jar. I haven't yet made it. I should have you over to teach me how.
Oh, sure.
But it's not the instant, just pour water every grain the same. And I have not traveled in Tunisia or Morocco, and I had never seen it before.
It's a beautiful product, isn't it?
It looked spectacular. Yeah. I'm eager to cook with it.
Yeah, and it's not anywhere near as complicated as people try to make it out to be. I mean, you do have to be a little careful with it, just as you have to be a little careful with, I mean, it is a form of pasta, after all. You have to be a little careful with pasta. You can't just throw it in the water and let it cook for 15 minutes and expect it to taste like anything at all or have any texture. Same thing with couscous. But it's not, you know, that elaborate business of steaming it and then turning it out and rubbing it and putting olive oil on it and putting it back in and wrapping a towel around it and steaming it again and going through that whole process two or three times. That really isn't necessary. I know where that couscous comes from. In fact, I visited those.
Wow.
It's six women who are sisters who are all fabulous cooks, and their brother makes olive oil. And each one of the sisters cooked something special for me, and one of them cooked couscous, and it was great.
Oh, you're making me hungry. Sam, is there anything that you've discovered that you're excited about right now?
Well, something came to me out of kind of necessity. Many years ago, Nancy came back from a trip to the Middle East and brought back a dozen or so small bags of individual housewives' version of Aleppo pepper from the city of Aleppo, which has been virtually destroyed. Mm. It's one of the great tragedies of the conflict in the Middle East. But we've been, and I fell in love with Aleppo peppers, and we started using them in large quantities at 4th Street, and then suddenly they weren't available anymore. So we had to start looking around, and I found a pepper from a town in Turkey called Urfa, I believe I've got it right, which is a purplish pepper because of the way it's produced. And it's incredibly aromatic, a little bit raisiny in its texture, not finely ground, with this amazing fruitiness and hints of smoke and a little bit of heat, but more sweet and complex. And I've been using it like crazy and putting it in everybody's Christmas stockings around our house.
So how do you spell Urfa? O-R-F-A?
No, U.
U-R-F-A. It's utterly amazing. And most of the spice companies online that had been supplying specialty Aleppo peppers now have it available, and I highly recommend it. It's really fun.
Mm. And what about you, Nancy? What is your new discovery?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm going to say yogurt, and that's going to sound really silly, but I discovered a particular yogurt in Belmont, Massachusetts, in a Greek shop that was about the best yogurt that I've ever had in my life. It's all what we call Greek style yogurt, which means that thickened yogurt. It is so delicious. It's made from sheep's milk. It's whole milk.
Sheep's milk.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And it's fabulous. So every time I go to Boston, I make a little swing out to Belmont and buy my supply of yogurt. It lasts a long time too. And I haven't been doing much of anything with it. I've been putting it in a bowl and slicing some bananas and pouring some Maine maple syrup on it and having it for breakfast.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I started making yogurt this past year. Patty White got me. Our reporter, yeah. Patty White, got me turned on to it. And now I don't understand why people buy yogurt. And I have shared. It's so easy.
Yeah.
And it's so much better, mm-hmm. You know, in the crock pot. Mm-hmm. And
now you have to make ricotta next, which is also very easy.
Is
and
it
much
as
better.
Easy?
Oh, are we
going to
have a ricotta fight now?
Uh-oh. I think I'm going to lose.
A ricotta fight.
A ricotta fight. Okay, we're going to have that. We'll have that off air because we have to go to a break.
Okay.
When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the World Affairs Council. Connecting Maine and the world with international speakers and global topics. Learn more at wacmaine.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, how the digital revolution has changed the mating process.
It used to be that you would find compatibility first and then learn more about someone else's attributes. And now you see all the attributes and then you learn about compatibility later.
Happy Valentine's Day. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
And you can hear Freakonomics Radio tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. Super Thursday is now in the rearview mirror. Thank you for doing your part. Over $235,000 was raised to help ensure Maine Public Radio continues to be the station you choose and trust. And we welcomed in 645 new members. All in this one day, a great way to take care of business. And of course, we always thank ongoing members who continue to support this station day in and day out. Together, we make Maine Public Radio all that it can be. Thanks again.
Well, I'm happy to tell you we've survived the break. We're all still here in one piece. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, news, advice, and inspiration from the world of food. In the studio with me, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, cookbook author, food writer, and speaker. Sam Hayward, chef and co-owner of 4th Street and Scales Restaurants. And Peggy Gradinsky, food editor at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, I humbly told these expert guests that I was making my own yogurt, but Sam, you've one-upped me, or ten-upped me.
No, over Christmas, my daughter-in-law gave me a butter churn, a little tabletop hand-crank butter churn that works really well. So since Christmas time, I've been looking around for interesting cream from different dairies, mostly unpasteurized and hopefully from lots and lots of butterfat in them. And my grandson and I have been cranking out butter, and it's been really fun to do different creams, different ways of culturing the cream before we churn it, and then mixing a flavoring it with different salts before we actually use it. That's been really fun.
How long does it take?
Well, it depends on the cream and it depends on temperature, but typically about 20 minutes of churning before it comes. It's amazing. It's really quite simple to do.
Okay, so that's kind of meditative. 20 minutes isn't too long.
Yeah.
And fun.
And I have Maine Public on while I'm...
good man. That's a good man. Christopher on Facebook asks, how do you prepare urchin?
I don't. I eat it raw.
Right.
You can put it in butter, though.
You can
I've
put it in
butter.
One of the ways that we used to do it at our restaurant was to blend it with butter in a food processor and then use the butter to make thickened emulsified butter sauces, which is pretty amazing to do. But almost always raw or barely poached in some other mixture, a soup, a broth, a stew. Fantastic finish to a sauce. Fantastic. It's beautiful, kelpy, iodine-y, oceanic flavor. Once you've become addicted to it, it's pretty hard to give it up.
I wish we had, on the south coast of Italy, they had these little shacky sort of restaurants along the beach, like our lobster shacks, sort of. And you go there during urchin season, and they bring you a great pile of urchins, and they're already cracked open. So you take a piece of crispy, crusty bread, and you dip it in there, and you scoop out the urchin roe, maybe sprinkle a few drops of lemon on it, and eat it just like that. What
Yum.
A great idea for a Maine lobster shack.
That does sound wonderful. Email from Seth. I just started my curried chicken stock and put 10 garlic heads in the oven to roast when your show came on. I'm making roasted garlic cream soup with brandy and a huge spinach salad for friends tonight. We'll finish with orange-scented olive oil cake and honey brown sugar glaze. Seth, you did not include your address for us to come over tonight.
Or the time and what wine you want us to bring.
Yeah. It sounds like a great meal, though. Yeah. It's the kind of thing, on a night like tonight, blustery and cold, it's just perfect. That garlic soup. And, if you're coming down with anything at all the garlic in the soup will bring you right back to life again.
Mm. We'll go to a call. This is Ann calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Ann, I can barely hear you. Are you on a speakerphone?
No, I took it off speakerphone.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me now?
A little better. Yeah, go ahead.
Page could afford elective surgery to lose weight, possibly paid for by the state. There are many, many people in Maine who cannot afford food, and he has cut nutritional assistance for Mainers. So I just wanted to make a plea for people to lobby, to love their neighbors by lobbying to get reinstatement of benefits, and also perhaps your experts could talk about cooking for food banks.
Okay, so we'll go with the last part of that, cooking for food pantries. Have you all done that? And do you know what food pantries will accept and will not accept if you are interested in cooking something for them?
Most of them will not accept. They cannot accept something that's been cooked in a home kitchen. It has to be cooked in a certified kitchen, like a restaurant kitchen or there are these kitchens that exist all over the state, and that's what they have to use for health reasons, because who knows what the person might have put in that soup or how long it might have sat in the refrigerator before they decided to donate it to the food bank.
Okay.
So it's to go and help them. I've done that in Rockland at St. Peter's Church, go and help them. Usually what they have me doing is setting the table because they don't trust me in the kitchen. But but I would love to get in the kitchen and put a little curry powder, like what Seth said, a little curry powder in the soup, because I think that would do them a lot of good. No, but joking aside, it is a very serious problem in Maine. And it mostly, or I should say, it affects more young children and old people. Food insufficiency, and that's not always income related. Sometimes it's caused by ignorance of what you ought to be eating or what you ought to be feeding your children, but it's a very serious problem. Shelley Pingree said that 1 in 4 Maine school children goes to bed hungry at night. And to me, who have gone to bed hungry a couple of times in my life, it is a horrifying thing to think that it's something you don't volunteer and you can't get out of.
We'll go to Eric, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was pleased to hear that you have Nancy on, who's done some great traveling in the Middle East. And I'm just interested to hear her comments about hummus. It's a food I love. I eat it all the time. And it seems to come in different textures, and I've had it in different parts of the country. And I'm just wondering if Nancy had any thoughts on hummus and maybe a little bit of history, too.
Oh, thanks. Eric. And I don't think you're the only one. I have a friend who's obsessed with hummus, has tried everything from Worcestershire sauce to soy sauce all sorts of things to make the perfect hummus.
No, I make it in a very purist kind of way because I learned how to make it in Lebanon. And that's Lebanon, the country, not Lebanon, Maine. And I think it should be made with chickpeas. I mean, hummus, after all, means chickpeas. So you can't have a black bean hummus because that's like saying we're having black bean chickpeas. So you make it with chickpeas, but don't make it with chickpeas from a can. Boil up enough chickpeas so that you've got a lot of them and you can keep them in the freezer and haul them out and they'll be cooked by you and they'll be ever so much better than anything that comes in a can. Mash them up, mix them with garlic, mix them with olive oil, mix them with salt, a little cumin sometimes. And one thing I learned to do...
No tahini?
Oh, tahini. Of course, tahini. Oh. That's the most important thing of all. But one of the things that I learned the last time I was in Syria, gosh, oh, will I ever go to Syria again? One of the things I learned the last time I was there was to boost the kind of protein content of the chickpeas by a little ground lamb that's been seared in olive oil on top of the stove with a little chopped garlic and chopped onion. And that goes on top of it just as a kind of garnish on the top of the hummus. And it's fabulous.
Mm. Can I tell you something that I do? It depends whether there's all sorts of textures you can have hummus, but I happen to like it quite smooth and silky, and this takes forever, so you have to be dedicated, but it is very meditative, to borrow a phrase from you, is I peel the chickpeas.
Oh, my brother was talking
really
about that.
Lovely.
He said he rubs them between his hands.
Yeah.
Is that
the
how you do it?
The skin comes right off. It will just almost fall off if you've cooked the chickpeas enough. And the other thing I was going to recommend also as something to put on top of it is, I think it's, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, it's called soug. It might be Ethiopian. It has a lot of cilantro.
It's Yemeni.
Yemeni.
It's a fabulous. We did that in a cooking class last week. It's got cilantro and sometimes a little mint and parsley and cumin and
something
olive oil.
Hot.
Yeah,
and
a little hot chili. It is wonderful.
And you pour it over the hummus.
So, Eric,
really
see
delicious.
What you started?
And I will also add, I am also a purist, and I come at it more from a language point of view than from a food person point of view, but I'm a former English major, and I edit and write all day long. And we've started to use hummus just to mean dip.
Yeah, yeah.
Those things are dips. Hummus is a particular thing.
Okay.
If you're putting beets in it and other things, that's a dip.
And I should say, I never make hummus because I have two really good friends in Bodenham who make brilliant hummus. And so I rely on them. I always have a supply if I need it.
Oh, Eric, thanks so much for your call. Nina on Facebook asks, I'm looking for suggestions for an easy dinner with friends, a hearty vegetable stew or lasagna. Do you have any suggestions? Sam, I'm tossing to you on this
one. So are you asking for meatless stews, or are you looking for...
Well, you know, it's on Facebook, so we can't ask her, but it sounds like it.
Okay.
And I know that you've been cooking meatless a lot recently. We've talked about this.
In my own home, yeah.
Yeah.
I do it fairly often, not as much as I probably should, because we never know who's going to be coming to dinner in my household. But I love to do... This time of year is perfect for root vegetables. Mm-hmm. And my wife is a really good gardener and always has onions and different potatoes and other hardy, storable winter vegetables around. So those are the things that we tend to use. I love to use stalks when I'm finishing those things. I love roasted root vegetables in the wintertime. So that's primarily the kind of thing that I do rather than doing stews. But, boy, almost anything this time of year can be turned into a soup. Even a smooth, velvety soup made with celery root and lots of garlic cloves that have been roasted off together. And
Jerusalem artichokes.
Are they around right now?
I've seen them. Yeah,
no,
I don't know whether they're local or not.
Okay.
Yeah, I did. I bought them in the Belfast Farmers Market a couple of weeks ago.
We usually buy our Jerusalem artichokes or girasoles or sunchokes, or they're going by a bunch of different names, in the spring when they're dug right after the thaw. And that seems to be when they're at their sweetest. So that's interesting to use right now.
I mean, you could, if she wants to turn it into a stew, you could almost make a sort of root vegetable pot pie and then make, you know, squash biscuits or something to put over it as the crust. And that's relatively easy. And you could do the two parts of it ahead and then just warm up the stew a little bit and then put the biscuits on top and bake it when you're ready to eat.
Sounds delicious. I mean, the other thing to do, of course, this is bean season as well. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
So that's a really important winter vegetable. And I think about beans and chowders probably above all else this time of year. But a chowder made with vegetables instead of with seafood isn't out of the question. Perfectly understandable. But I also love the taste of caramel, the caramelization
of
that
roasting,
you can get when you're roasting or searing in a skillet until there is lots of good, delicious brown stuff to deglaze with a stock. So to cut up carrots, to cut up other root vegetables, parsnips, leeks right now, onions, garlic, and brown those in a skillet or on a roasting pan.
Turnips.
And then turnips right now, absolutely. And then deglaze with the stock and turn it into a delicious soup. Fantastic.
So can we show up at Sam's house for dinner?
Let's do it.
Sounds good. Well, I'm going to follow up on Nina's question by asking this. All of us have weeks where we're feeling a little more frugal than others. So we think, what can I make for my family for the least amount of money possible?
Beans.
You're going to say, and in my family, I have a couple dishes I go to, which is a white bean soup or a rice and lentil and onion dish, but I would love some more ideas.
Oh, boy, I would always fall back on beans. There are so many bean recipes all over the world. You know, we think Maine baked beans, but they don't have to be baked with molasses and salt pork. They could be baked with cumin and garlic and olive oil and have an entirely different flavor. Or they could be baked with curry and bay leaves in a kind of Indian fashion. I don't know that this is a real Indian recipe, but certainly there are loads of legume recipes in the cuisine of South Asia, for India, Pakistan, places like that. So, you know, it's a debate I have often with people who are looking for recipes for things. Go to the internet and just type it in.
I do love that. Well, and the reason I found my onion and lentil dish is I didn't want to go to the store one day, and I typed in onion and lentil, and 72 recipes came up, and I chose the easiest one.
And yet, paradoxically, so many cookbooks are coming out. It's mystifying.
Yes, it is.
But I was going to add to that, I lived in Japan a long time ago, and sometimes when I'm very tired and it's a cold winter day, and this is also very inexpensive, is I'll just make a quick miso soup and add a huge pile of nice Japanese noodles and cut up some tofu and then anything else I have around. Right now, if it were root vegetables, I might throw in some turnips, or I sometimes julienne ginger and throw in a few little sticks of ginger.
The other thing we tend to forget about in terms of cheap food is eggs.
Eggs. I was just going to say, throw an egg on it.
A dozen, 1,000 different ways of making eggs, whether they're hard-boiled and served with a sauce or scrambled with some kind of – with vegetables, a tortilla – a Spanish tortilla, which is the same thing as a frittata, which is the same thing as a pan omelet, I guess.
May I put in a plug for a recipe that we ran in the Press Herald on Wednesday, which came from Stella Hernandez of Lolita, She's been writing a few columns for us, and she had a recipe for combining both the beans and the eggs and ham, Spanish ham, and it sounded really delicious and quite inexpensive. And also, since we started out by talking about Valentine's, kind of sexy to me.
Oh, okay. Kat on Facebook has a corollary question. Any suggestions for a college student on a thrifty budget? Variations on ramen noodles besides throwing that seasoning packet away. If you have a microwave and that's about it.
Boy, I've never had a microwave in my life. I don't know how to use them. I wouldn't know how to begin.
Sam, you have young adults in your life.
There are some cookbooks. I can't think of the name of them, but if they just Googled college cookbooks, there's a couple fairly recent within the last 2 or 3 year sort of hack cookbooks about how to use food from the dormitory that you might get, say, on the salad line buffet at your school. And then also having just a microwave and perhaps one spoon and one bowl. There's several cookbooks that have been written geared to that.
Oh, there's also that cookbook that came out last year that's a chef in California who wrote, I think it's called 10 Recipes, and he wrote it for his kid
son,
who was going off to college, and it's 10 basic recipes and then all the variations that you can do on it. And it's a wonderful book.
Okay, we do have to go to another break. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Dirigo Pines in Orono, offering a spectrum of retirement living options on a 68-acre wooded campus, dirigopines.com.
What if you were sick and got the wrong diagnosis?
He had told me that my symptoms didn't have a biological cause, but after we got out from the appointment, I walked back to my house, and I collapsed, and I couldn't get up for 4 months.
I'm Guy Raz. Misdiagnosis, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And you can tune in for the TED Radio Hour at its new time, Saturday at 1, and also Wednesday evenings at 11.
The travel restrictions imposed by President Trump meant a confusing last few weeks for refugee families fleeing war and students in New England here on visas.
When I left them, I said to them that I'm not sure that I can arrive to the United States. Maybe I will deport and I'll see you again.
On Next, we'll look at the impacts felt around the region, and we'll hear the voices of support for immigration restrictions. Join us for Next from the New England News Collaborative.
And you can hear Next coming up at Maine Calling today at 2 o'clock.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, foods and dishes of the season. In the studio with me, Sam Hayward, chef and co-owner of 4th Street and Scales Restaurants, Peggy Grodinski, food editor at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who is a cookbook author, food writer, and an expert in Mediterranean cuisine. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Earlier in the program, we were talking about hummus. We have several calls coming in about hummus, so I think I'm going to take one of them. Jeffrey in Kennebunkport, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, it's Jeff Bove in Kennebunkport. And I don't want to beat this issue to death, but that's kind of funny to say, right, because that's what you do to the chickpeas. There are two other kind of chickpeas that I have only in the last few years been aware of. One is called calachana, and they're called black, whole black gram.
They're used in a lot of Indian cooking.
Also in
Italy. Indian bean.
Right. And they're very, it gives a slightly coarser, they're smaller and harder. I always cook these in a pressure cooker. Till they're done, and when I make hummus, and they make a much more earthy hummus, if you like that. Some people might think it just tasted like dirt. The other one I found in a store, there's an Indian store in Scarborough, and it's called Green Chana, and they also had they all cook up the same color when you cook them, but they're not white, big, fluffy, plain things that might come out of a can. So these give different flavors to the hummus, and I kind of have a master recipe that I use for my spouse primarily, which is tahini, loads of olive oil, lots of lemon, and dry mustard, and that's what kind of makes it, and I tweak it depending on what her mood is. But there's another bean that I wanted to talk about. Maine's beans, right? We live in bean country. And that's there's some small fava beans, not the big, broad fava beans that we're used to seeing, but this is a Lebanese specialty called ful madamas.
Mm, it's right. Not just Lebanese.
Right.
Yeah. I've never seen this on a menu anywhere but in Toronto. They wouldn't tell us how to make it.
Oh, you can see it all over New York at Egyptian restaurants.
And it's in cookbooks. Right, it's in look at Claudia Roden's cookbooks, and you'll find it, or Elizabeth David's.
I'm fine with it. I just bought a case of 12 one-pound bags of it online from Zihad because we only got them canned, and Hannaford stopped carrying them canned at all, so that we couldn't get them. We could get them a couple places if we went around, but, you know, Kennebunk Port's in the middle of nowhere.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thanks for sharing your enthusiasm. And I'll ask my guests here in the studio, how do you spell that? How would you look
for that? F-O-U-L. Not F-O-O-L. F-O-U-L. So you think it's saying fowl, but it isn't. It's saying ful madamas.
It's a very common breakfast, correct me if I'm wrong,
in
the Middle East. But it is surprising to me because Middle Eastern food is, as we were saying earlier, so popular here now that I'm not seeing that on more breakfast menus at restaurants in the U.S. And I'm not just Egyptian or Middle Eastern, but just in general, I'm surprised it hasn't caught on. But I just wanted to add one more last thing to the hummus discussion, if you don't mind, which is that I used to live in Texas, and there, at certain times of year, you can get fresh chickpeas. Which I very rarely see here. I think I saw them once at Whole Foods, which is based in Texas, so perhaps that's why they were carrying them. But if you can get those are really fun to play
with. Would you make hummus with fresh chickpeas?
You know, I probably would not.
Yeah.
But there's lots of other fun things you can do with them, and they look like tiny little brains. They're kind of
so
fun
to look at. Excuse my ignorance about the subject, but is there any variety that either of you know about that would grow in Maine?
I think they require a very long growing season, okay. But our growing season, as you know, is getting longer. I think it's worth experimenting with or finding an Elliot Coleman solution with a hoop house that can be slid back and forth depending on the season. I think it would be I think lentils also would be a great bean to see grown in Maine.
And I have had them sprout in my refrigerator, so that's a start.
So you know that cool air is okay.
Exactly.
We'll go to Alex, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Really great conversation. I'm actually calling because I'm on my way to my parents. They have a small business, and I also have a small business. And we're getting ready to have cook a dinner there, kind of a pop-up. They have an inn, and it's just kind of a fun thing. We're using mostly the most local produce we can, local pork. It's going to be pretty fun. So
they do this at their inn.
Yeah, it's called the Inn at English Meadows. It's in Kennebunk. This is their second one that they've done. They pair with a chef, and then I have a business too, and I'm going to go and help them with some food. So we're food people, and I grew up cooking with my family, and I just love the culture around food here in Maine. It's kind of exciting, and I really am excited to be a part of it. So,
well, it definitely is exciting. It's interesting because I read an article a few years ago about these secret pop-up dinners in Los Angeles, but this is going on here in Maine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is. You guys check it out. I think they're on Eventbrite is the ticketing.
But beyond that, it's wonderful to hear somebody say, I just love the food culture here in Maine. I can't imagine anybody saying that 40 or 50 years ago because there was no food culture in Maine.
Well, two of you sitting in the studio have a big part to do with that. So I'm going to go to Hollowell and Sebastian. Hi, Sebastian. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Sebastian, hello. Are you still there? Darn. Well, I believe Sebastian wanted to ask about using seaweed, and it's a burgeoning industry here in Maine.
It is.
Do any of the three of you cook with seaweed?
Sure. There are so many. I don't know what the caller is writer. Is actually looking for specifically, but there's so much going on with seaweed, including some regulatory stuff that's got to be mentioned, because we really need to avoid over harvesting some of these slow growing alga. And I'm not sure again what the caller's looking for, but there are so many different ways to use. The primary one being grown around Portland right now is sugar kelp. And
it's being grown.
It's being grown on, in one case. The Bangs Island Mussel Company is actually growing them on their rafts out in Casco Bay. And we buy a lot of that from them. It's fantastic to use. There are several other species, and there actually have been harvesters, processors, distributors in Maine for seaweed and seaweed products for decades.
Right. But there is this kind of hippie element to it now,
exactly.
Which is very interesting. That guy, Larch Hansen, over in Gouldsboro, I think he is, mm-hmm. He is kind of the grandfather, the godfather, I should say, of a group of people who are, they're very aware of sustainability issues. And they're, as far as I can tell, they're doing a good job of maintaining the resource. But they're a kind of one man, one boat operations, and it's
that's the issue that we're coming to grips with. That the fear is that some big commercial operations are going to come in. There'll be a bunch of consolidation and mergers and acquisition, and suddenly we'll find out that we're getting kind of a corporate push against the small scale individual producer that we've been.
So Sam, I've had seaweed salad. How else do you use seaweed?
Oh my goodness! What I love about seaweed generally. Depending on the species, of course, is that burst of umami, that rich, meaty, savory taste that you can get from, say, soy sauce or mushrooms. There's a lot of that glutamate flavor that's also in many seaweeds. So to extract that, to make a broth like dashi, Japanese dashi, using using kelps is fantastic.
That's the broth that's the base of miso soup.
Exactly.
That you eat if you go to a Japanese restaurant.
But also, I think my daughter has used it because it's very crisp. Some of it's very crisp. You can crumble it between your hands and put it on top of pasta.
Okay, we just have about 4 minutes left. That's a great idea, Nancy. But I want to get to this tweet from John. He writes, "Can't fathom coming in from an hour of shoveling and having a bucket of hummus. Soups and stews, please." So maybe our last couple minutes, some sort of inspiration if you're thinking of making a stew tonight. Sam already mentioned, try to make a chowder with vegetables. It never would have occurred to me to mix milk and vegetables, but I might get brave enough to try that,
corn
Sam.
Corn chowder.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Corn chowder. I have a husband who doesn't like that, but I know that he's unusual. So,
what's not to like?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, what's wrong with chickpea soup? Instead of making hummus, let's make chickpea stew. Chickpeas are wonderful cooked. You might be a little. No, you're not too late to start supper now. You have to pre-soak your chickpeas by doing the USDA pre-soak method, where you put them in water, you bring them to a boil, you boil them for 1 minute, you turn it off, you let them soak for an hour, and then you drain them, and then you start to cook as if they'd soaked overnight.
And you can do that with black beans as well, right?
Any legume. Mm-hmm. You don't need to do it with lentils. So let's make a lentil stew tonight, and you don't have to worry about you don't have to worry about soaking anything at all. Lentils and vegetables. What a great idea.
Okay, lentil soup, corn chowder.
I love dal, going back to beans, but I have lots of recipes for that sort of little bowl of soup you get sometimes when you go to an Indian restaurant at the start. I really love that and cook it a lot in the winter. But going back to seaweed for a moment, I was going to say I've seen it on cocktail menus here in Portland. I've seen it in...
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. I've seen it in sort of little energy bars, like a little snacky kind of 4 p.m. pick-me-up. There's a cookbook that Barton Seaver, who is a sustainable fish guy who lives in Freeport, wrote late last year, or maybe it was the year before, about how to cook with seaweed, because presumably most people aren't so used to cooking with it.
Does one need to buy seaweed at the store, or if you live near the beach, can you go pull something?
You have to be sure of what you're pulling up. Yeah. I think it's
can't all seaweed?
You can't do everything with every one of them. Rockweed, for instance, is harvested heavily here, but it mostly goes into industrial processing because it has a lot of something in it. I can't remember what it is. Carrageenan. If you know what you're doing, sure you can, but I would feel more comfortable getting it from someone who knows what they're doing.
I mean, a lot of people in Maine's history used seaweeds and marsh grasses to fertilize farm fields.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact,
a lot of people still do.
Yeah, and one of my but you got to be careful about what you're taking. But one of the farmers that we use at Forest Street who raises lambs offshore, the lambs actually go down at low tide and eat the rack, the sun dried rack that washes up on the shore, and you can hear them crunching. And he and I disagree about this, but I think you can taste a difference in the lamb meat when it's first off the island.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing.
Okay, so I have a bunch of I know a bunch of people who haven't had lunch yet are very hungry right now. I really wanted to talk about the veg-centric trend, but we're out of time, so we'll have to have all of you back to talk about that. Thank you so much for being here. Peggy Grodinski, food editor at the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Nancy Harmon Jenkins, cookbook author, award-winning author of several cookbooks, food writer and speaker. And Sam Hayward, the award-winning chef and co-owner of 4th Street and Scales Restaurants in Portland. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.